Hello and welcome to the Farmer Forum podcast. I'm your host, Jonah Comstock. When Alphabet announced in 2021 that its AlphaFold AI could predict the structure of almost every known protein, it was a major story, not just in the farmer world, but beyond, as AI really proved its value in life sciences. But that was far from the end of the story for AI and protein folding. My guest today is Glenn Gowers, co-founder of Basecamp Research, and he's going to tell us about a recent preprint that just came out, some big news they just shared, and how Basecamp is writing the next chapter of the story of AI and protein folding. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Thanks very much for having me, Jenna.
So tell me a little bit, kind of in, let's back way up to start. In layperson's terms, what is the kind of the big deal about what these AIs can do when it comes to protein folding?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all appreciate, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry, how important a problem to solve protein folding is. Now, of course, it doesn't get you all the way to understanding protein function or complex behaviors, but certainly understanding proteins in their 3D format is way more important than understanding them simply in their two-dimensional or even just one-dimensional sort of format. Now, that obviously doesn't take away from what you might need to do through X-ray crystallography and more detailed studies, but the closer and closer we can get from an in silico perspective towards true protein structures, the what we gain in scalability. And for us, that's really the crux of this, is how do we get near complete, very accurate structures at as high a throughput as possible? And obviously AlphaFold was an enormous step change in being able to do that. What we sort of identified, though, as a big gap at Basecamp Research is AlphaFold's ability to do that depends on its ability to see a huge diversity and range of proteins in a step that's called MSA, or multi-sequence alignment generation. And that step was really leveraging a lot of these public data sets that we found to be incredibly small, limited, and very undiverse relative to what they should be learning from, which in theory would be all of biodiversity and all of nature. So what we're showing in this preprint, just to kind of introduce it, is a new type of approach here where we're not really changing much to do with the model itself in terms of the architectures or entire retraining. We're simply saying, well, if we show this model a far greater representation of true diversity, true biodiversity, does it get better and better? And what we found is overwhelmingly across an enormously wide range of protein tasks, whether that's a plant protein, human protein, synthetic protein, it was better at understanding those structures up to about 6x in one case, just simply by having it see a much greater diversity of proteins. And we can dive into sort of how we went and did that. But I think that's a really important step change now in AI models more generally outside of even just structure.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, it's not surprising that better data is going to lead to better performance. But it sounds like it's more than just that. It's really, you know, you use the term step change. In terms of the actual kind of usefulness of these tools in the real world, you know, does this sixfold increase, is this really kind of going to make a difference in how this is used for drug discovery?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, better structures are going to be the backbone, for want of a pun, for a lot of work across drug discovery more generally, right? You know, if you're working with incomplete or inconsistent structures that aren't accurate, you know, then if you apply tools on top of that, like physics-based validations or molecular modeling or docking, these are all going to be sort of impacted and a lot lower performing if your base structure you're working on isn't accurate. And that's, again, something that we showed in the preprint, is if we then apply a docking model on top of this with a small molecule drug binding into a small molecule binding into a protein, that binding interaction is more accurately predicted simply by having that correct structure, which makes a lot of sense. But you know, to your point, Joni, the story doesn't stop with just a better structure. It's what you can then do if you have access to lots and lots of very accurate structures. And that's what we hope to shift.
So tell me a little more about the data that you used here, because it's pretty interesting. And it's some of the value add that Basecamp Research itself is bringing here.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's potentially one of the sort of dirty secrets in some ways of the biotech industry, is how sort of poor a lot of these public data sets are, particularly when you then see how pervasive they are across an entire industry. So let's just dive into that a little bit. You know, what are the data sets that people are using today? You may know the names. You know, one's called UniPro, NCBI, Magnify. These are all names of data sets. But broadly, they all share the same sort of structure, particularly with how they're created, that these are academic studies being done by other people, sometimes companies as well, but always for different purposes. And they're sort of aggregated into these large data sets, these sequence repositories, and put online. And there's various levels of sort of refinement of these and checking that they sort of make sense. But broadly, we see that they are very undiverse. You know, if you were to cluster some of these data sets, for example, NCBI, to even just 90%, you see a huge drop in the number of representative sequences there. And they really lack in size even. That, you know, the size of NCBI is still from, well, half of it is still from just 12 species. You know, that really doesn't represent the size of the design space that biodiversity itself is operating in. So when we started the company, we took sort of a step back to say, well, from a training machine learning model perspective, you know, what would perfect data look like at a very foundational level across biotech? And for us, it would be understanding biology at its core level, so DNA. It would be understanding it at the entire breadth of design space possible. And one of the best tools we have of that is nature itself. It spent 4 billion years probing this sequence space at the DNA level. And then the other element to this would that you would want a lot of this data to be very, very well contextualized. And so you would want to understand how does these sort of proteins interlink to each other? How do they interlink to the environments they were found in? How do they interlink to other species in those samples? And that's what adds this kind of complexity and this richness to this sort of ideal training data set. And context, I suppose, would be another way of describing that. So when we put all of that together, you know, when we were founding the company, it was really clear to us that biodiversity itself was going to be this incredible asset if only it could be machine readable. And if we think of where we are today, you know, there are companies in the past that have obviously looked at biodiversity and understood it or tried to understand it at a larger scale. But what we've really lacked up until more recently is the tools to make it very machine readable and therefore particularly applicable to machine learning algorithms. And for that, you know, dropping costs of DNA sequencing, the ability to collect this data at a very, very large scale globally. You know, these were things that we had to sort of put in place at the start of the company and have been really important for the scalability of this.
Let me just dig in really like nuts and bolts. How are you collecting this data? What samples is it coming from? How do you get that diversity that was sort of missing from the data sets before?
Yeah, so we built partnerships around the world with various different biodiverse areas and countries and governments and things like this. In fact, if you go to our website, we've got a great short video on our partnership with Costa Rica, just as a sort of flagship example of the work that we do there. And a big part of this is getting the right legal and sort of regulatory compliance measures in place. And this is a whole area we can and probably should dive into a bit. But this component of it has historically been really ignored. And I think the impact of that means the usability from a legal standpoint of public data is really limited. And we really see this internally as a company as a bit of a time bomb. That is underlying these data sets. So in terms of the data that we collect, we then say, well, let's make sure that from day one, this is all structured correctly, not just from a technical angle, but from a legal and therefore liability angle. So we build these partnerships. We adhere to access and benefit sharing principles set out even as early as 1992 by the CBD, but more recently, the things like the Nagoya Protocol. And we really make sure that we've got those agreements in place with the countries we're working with. So for example, that Costa Rica partnership, we've been there with training, we share data back, we collaborate on various different projects together. We employ people there part-time to be able to sort of run these programs, and we share knowledge on the protocols we're using, et cetera. And all of that is really towards making these more collaborative really than they are anything else. Now, in return as well, we also pass royalties from any money that we make in our commercial partnerships back to these biodiversity hotspots. And actually, we've distributed a really good number of these royalties so far on money that we've made. So, you know, all of that together, not just from a technical standpoint, but I think even just sort of structurally and legally and even ethically, I think, you know, this data set is really standing quite different to what exists publicly or even otherwise by other companies too.
Now you've got this better protein folding engine. It's based on your data, which is really data from all of your partners, but put together. How do you get that out to all the different researchers who might be able to benefit from it? What's the kind of the business model for you guys and the go forward for this work?
Yeah, so really the North Star for us as a company is not just to have good models or good tools, but to really actually build products that make a difference in the world. And whether that's impacting therapeutics for patient health and safety, all the way through to environmental issues like bioremediation or more sustainable manufacturing. You know, being able to solve those product problems is absolutely our North Star. So we build partnerships. We have 12 active partnerships to date that really cover that breadth of activities. And we've been public with some, for example, even with Protein Evolution Inc., which is in being able to create circular recycling sort of process enzymatically for plastics, through to bioremediation, through to chemical manufacturing, and obviously in therapeutics as well. We want to solve those sorts of problems, right? And these models are absolutely very, very helpful tools that help us get there, but they're one of many. And we actually, we fold in lots of different models and improve them using our data set, whether that's across protein generation, protein annotation, protein folding, as we're talking about here, but across a bunch of other different domains as well. You know, how do we use the data that we have to understand biology at a much deeper level and then use that to design better products? And we build partnerships around those products, as opposed to building solely sort of good tools and just leaving it at that. You know, I think that would be a hugely missed opportunity potentially.
We haven't talked yet about the partnership with NVIDIA. That was part of the announcement that went out today. You guys are working with them on their BioNeMo platform that they, I believe, announced this year at JPM. Adds a generative AI aspect into this. So talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, we're part of NVIDIA's Inception program, which we'd announced previously. And that's hugely exciting for us because, you know, there is an enormous interest and growth in the as you say, the generative AI sort of world. I think there is a deep appreciation amongst that community, as you alluded to at the very beginning there, that, you know, data quality is practically everything. That yes, model design and architectures and how things are trained and is all incredibly important, but fundamentally the data that you're training off, the patterns that exist within that data, are paramount to being able to have successful models that do a range of tasks, you know, not just structure or anything, including protein design, genome design, biological system, deeper understanding. And I think, you know, that's really the basis of why we found it very interesting to be working with NVIDIA through this Inception program. Is because they too really see and understand those sorts of issues that are being faced. And I also think what's interesting there is being a tech company, you know, they are seeing these issues not just in biotech, but across all domains of AI and machine learning, that the quality of the data is everything. And so I think, you know, it's very exciting for us to be working with a lot of their team. They're extremely collaborative and fascinating and extremely talented individuals who really deeply understand this sort of space. And to be bringing to the table, you know, brand new data that we think is far more powerful from a machine learning perspective, and being able to apply that across lots of domains is it makes for very exciting interactions.
So, what's next for you guys in terms of, you know, the next step of this research? Are you looking to kind of further validate what you found here? Are there kind of even bigger and better data sets that you can include to make this model even more successful and predictive?
Yeah, so we actually we see it continuously improve. In fact, actually, even since that preprint went out, simply because the fact that the data set we are building here is not static. In fact, it's growing faster and faster, not just in its pure size, but in its importance, right? So, you know, is it really describing new proteins in new areas, and are we adding new dimensions into this data set that previously didn't exist? And we keep adding more and more of that. So that will keep improving the existing models that we're working on here, example base fold. But what's next is really expanding this more foundationally, not just to proteins, but into, can you design entire genomes? Can you use that therapeutically to say, well, we understand how genome integration systems work even. You know, this is all patterns that are described within our data set. And we're now exploring all the different models, foundation models too, that would be able to learn from this sort of data and folding them all in. And again, towards this North Star of how do we make this improve products, the success of these products, the design of these products, the freedom to operate of products that we work on through our partnerships. So for us, we remain laser focused on that, expanding and scaling up the partnerships that we're working on. We're building therapeutic partnerships at the moment with a handful of really fascinating companies, which we hope to be announcing soon. And that will all come from us continuing to grow this data set itself and explore models that will kind of unleash its power.
Thinking a little more long term and maybe a little more existentially, Is the end game here just bigger and better, more efficient drug discovery? Or since we're automating aspects of drug discovery, and obviously that comes with a big asterisk, does this kind of tend towards precision medicine in the future, you know, towards being able to design something almost on the fly for a particular patient based on their gene needs or for ultra rare? I mean, is that the sorts of things you guys are thinking about in the far future?
Yeah, certainly. You know, in the very long term, you absolutely want to be able to understand the design rules of biology to the extent that, exactly as you say, for precision medicine, you understand the context of the patient you're trying to treat with what modality would be needed and how to design that modality. And then if you need to make that, how to engineer that modality and manufacture it. All of that, those steps are all to do with having a foundational understanding of how biology works. And biology being very complex will require more and more complex data sets to be able to describe that. So in the sort of near term, you know, we put out some press before to show that we're working on gene writers and the ability for these large serine recombinases, as they're called, to really understand how they work and where in the genomes they would be applicable for. And that is all absolutely in part towards precision medicine and being able to understand if we want to rewrite a genome in this very particular and specific location, do we understand what tools will be able to do that and how to develop those? And that's the first step for us. That then goes beyond, you know, once you understand how to write genomes, you potentially understand what to rewrite them with and where to target that and for what patients that might be valuable for. And increasingly, I think we're seeing the utility of companies being able to integrate this kind of complexity of data across lots of different sort of steps, if you like, of the drug discovery pipeline. And that's absolutely where I think this goes. Where I think it goes even further than that is not just limited to drug design. You know, I think the ability to understand how to write genomes, even that as an example, I think has huge applications all the way from industrial design, metabolic engineering for manufacturing of chemicals through to, as you say, sort of medicine and precision medicine.
Sure. And also, you know, like weird sci-fi stuff, right? Like super soldiers, right? I mean, is there a point where we know too much about the genome?
Well, I struggle to see sort of how more and more knowledge turns into a negative. There's always a case to be made that there should be responsible use of these technologies. And there's absolutely a conversation there.
Just like AI, right? Ethics always need to be.
Exactly. There should always be.
Ongoing conversation.
Certainly. Always need to be an ongoing conversation. You know, I personally see a really big risk around not understanding the technologies that you're working with enough. And that's where I think this data becomes really important is, you know, when we're engineering biology and designing new systems, do we understand how they're behaving? Do we understand why they evolved and how we might engineer them to be better and safer in the future? And all of that is knowledge derived from data, derived from insights. And that's critically important. Then obviously making sure that we have the right sort of ethics and safety protocols in place is a wider societal conversation we absolutely should be having. But more knowledge is always important.
Well, and that brings me to what I really wanted to kind of bring us towards is this idea of like one of the big conversations about AI, I think whenever we talk about AI, but especially in life sciences, is what is going to be the role of the computer and what's going to be the role of the human. And that's in drug discovery. What does this kind of technology do, and what do you still need the researchers for? You know, what's the interplay there? How are they guiding the research and drug discovery? And as we do improve these models, does that relationship change, or is it just kind of smoother?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily binary that either, you know, it is going to be something that is fully computational in silico or fully lab-based and needing a human in the loop. I think there will always be a need for really deep and detailed domain knowledge of where you're planning to apply AI. And AI is an incredibly helpful tool to be able to get you there and ideally to get to a point where the AI is teaching you something and allowing you to sort of iterate on ideas and hypotheses. I think that's where it gets really, really interesting. And we see that trend with some companies, for example, we're talking here about DeepMind and Isomorphic Labs. You know, I think that's a really nice marrying of a lot of deep domain expertise in drug discovery combined with all the power that they can bring with the AI that they're and the models that they're building. It's that confluence of the two coming together that I think is really important. I think if you have a mismatch in any one direction, it can cause problems. And I think the problem we see at the moment is there is a mismatch where you can have a lot of deep domain knowledge and a lot of great lab infrastructure and ability to do testing and screening. And yet the data and knowledge underlying that from the available data sets is so limited that you're really not making the most of that investment. And that's where we see a sort of big gap at the moment. You know, what we're planning to do here is create data sets and layer on top of that models that become smarter and smarter to then be able to almost be sort of professor level, where it can teach people things about biology. You know, hey, in nature, it may have solved it like this. And this is what a system designed to do X, Y, Z would have looked like had evolution come up for. You know, how do you ask nature for help? That's I think, where this could go. And that augments the ability of a human scientist to be able to go and build a product.
Yeah, that's a very cool idea. I like that phrasing of, you know, sort of like you're asking nature how it would have done it. And then the computer is extrapolating that answer. Anything we
haven't talked about? Yeah, in some ways, I think, you know, you...
No, go ahead. Sorry.
So I think maybe an analogy can sort of help there. You know, that I think, you know, as other industries have moved to a computer-aided design or CAD sort of mentality, even something as sort of traditional as like building a bridge, you know, if you can have a computer understand all the laws of physics, well, you can build and simulate bridges in silico all you like. You then, of course, have to have that built into the real world with a real builder. But can you get to a point where you design it in a computer once and then you go and build it once? You know, you're not building lots and lots of small models in the middle. You know, the biotech industry, I think, is a very long way away from that. You know, we're using labs at the moment as part of discovery processes, as part of this very, very kind of laborious kind of validation processes really early on in the drug discovery process. And that's where I think computers and particularly AI can have a huge impact if we have the right data sets. Is do a lot of that early heavy lifting, that iteration on ideas, as we were saying before, learning from nature and the natural world in a really intelligent way, such that when you then go into that lab and that infrastructure, you really are making the most of it, and you're able to validate the assets that are coming off the in silico platform and move very quickly through to whatever product development it is that you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah, that makes so much sense. In the example you said about the bridge, I mean, technology is going to take off in situations where doing it in the real world is expensive and unwieldy, right? And in that is kind of the case in life sciences. We become a nerd to it, but you know, animal studies are more expensive and human studies are more expensive still. So, and anything you can do in a computer could have a huge impact in that sort of realm.
Absolutely. And you know, companies like Big Pharma and other biotechs have invested huge amounts of money into this lab infrastructure. And so when we see companies using that lab infrastructure to basically just be searching for needles in a haystack in high throughput manners, I think is an enormously missed opportunity. If you had the right sort of computational models or AI that could make the most of those investments that they've made, I think it would be a far more efficient industry. And also you'd just be able to make probably products at a far greater success rate and just products that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to make for the fact that it would have previously cost so much to be able to find it using the lab screen.
So anything we haven't talked about yet that you think is an important piece of this puzzle, anything you're excited about or even looking at more broadly in the literature, stuff other people are working on that might be relevant, anything like that?
Well, maybe something that we touched on but didn't sort of dive too much into is really the sort of the liability issues that we sort of see with public data today. And there's a huge sort of movement happening at the UN level, things like the Nagoya Protocol or the BBNJ or the Oceans Treaty being discussed. And this is really putting a huge question mark over the ability to use these public data sets for commercial research and commercial product development. You know, I think that's a huge issue that's not being sort of talked about enough. And, you know, increasingly, I think we're going to see countries possibly litigate on people using these public data sets. And so, you know, this is something we wanted to make sure that we were really correcting as early as we could in the process to say, well, let's make sure that the data sets of the future really are improved upon a lot more in terms of their sort of legal clarity around them. And that's really why we went about the partnerships the way we have.
What is, I mean, without getting too far in the weeds as we come to the end of our podcast, but what is the reason for that? Those problems that exist with the data? I mean, is it silos and proprietary data, or is it data that was maybe collected in a time before we knew all the things we might want to do with it. So there's uncertainty about the privacy. What are kind of the root causes there?
I think one of the big ones is that largely a lot of this public data was collected for one purpose, almost always an academic reason to answer a biological question. And then as part of that publication process, uploaded into public repositories without necessarily the anticipation, at least from a legal point of view, that those sequences would then be pulled down and used for an entirely different purpose, i.e. product development in a commercial setting. And this has really been something that a lot of countries around the world have really woken up to, and have started to legislate against, to say, well, look, you know, these public data sets are not fit for commercialization. We haven't had an agreement with the person collecting that data that it could be used commercially. And so if you are using it commercially, you really need to come and talk to us. And today, 16 countries are currently legislating it in that manner. Now, I don't think enough companies really understand that that's the case. And so are sort of blindly using these public data sets under the assumption that because it's public data, it can be used in a commercial setting, where that's really not the case. And we're seeing this in other fields as well. I think, you know, the New York Times suing OpenAI, I think that's been very well publicized around the use of copyrighted information in training data. And I think it's a similar sort of ethos here. This is to say, biodiversity data is owned by the countries that they originate from, or the biodiversity is owned by the countries that they originate from. And so if you're going to use that information to develop something commercial, they ought to see some benefit coming back. And that's really the spirit of the Nagoya Protocol and the CBD back from 1992.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Glenn. We'll, of course, be including a link to the latest news and to that preprint. But if you want to send some information, too, about the is it the Nicolai Protocol?
Yeah, the Nagoya Protocol. Yeah, one of many.
Yeah, we can include that in the landing page, too, in case folks want to learn more about how they can get involved there. But thank you so much for joining me. This is a very interesting world that I don't know as much about as I'd like. So I appreciate you walking me through some of the details here. And congratulations on the preprint and good luck going forward.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Jonah. I really appreciate it.
That concludes this episode of the Pharma Forum podcast. You can find more information about this episode, including a download link and information about other installments in the series, at pharmaforum.com/podcast. The Pharma Forum podcast is also available on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, Stitcher, and Podme, where you can find and subscribe by searching for Pharma Forum. And don't forget to visit our website, where you can sign up for daily news and analysis bulletins, and to follow us on Twitter at @PharmaForum. Thanks for listening.